Hello, everybody, and welcome to Kentucky Ag Matters, a podcast designed to inform and educate both producers and consumers about all matters affecting agriculture. Special thanks to WKDZ, your Ag Edge Network, for the help in bringing you this show. On this week's show, David and Vicki will visit with Dr. Jordan Shockley, Associate Extension Professor for Ag Economics at the University of Kentucky. This week's topic will be understanding and participating in carbon markets. And as always, we will wrap things up with this week's timely tip. Thanks so much for joining us, and we hope you enjoy the show. How's everybody doing today?
Doing good.
Doing good. It's Friday.
Yeah, we're on the move again. Roving reporters, if you will, or a roving show. We are at the Kentucky Soybean Association's boardroom, and we really want to thank Miss Debbie Ellis and Becky Kinder and Ray Wagner for having us out, and we really appreciate them letting us be out here. We got to come down here and meet with Dr. Jordan Shockley, and it was just a real opportunity for us, and we needed to take it, and we appreciate them letting us have this space to do this.
That's right. That's that Southern hospitality that we have in this part of the world.
Absolutely.
So can't
beat
that.
I'm not sure that happens in the Golden Triangle much.
It may not. No. It may be more down this way, you think?
I suspect. That's kind of the way I feel about it.
It could be. You could be onto something, David.
I've been around a minute or two, and it sure feels like that.
You said that, not me. So, you said that. Well, you all may have seen, too, this week on social media and that it's National Agriculture Week this week. So I think that's pretty cool that, that we have our own week. That's it seems like you have a lot of special days now for everything, but we get a whole week.
Yeah, so. And it's a great thing because, every day out of the year we need to be thanking our farmers and for all that they do. And I don't think they get enough appreciation a lot of times. And sometimes they don't want to. They don't want a lot of fanfare and that type thing, but we really need to take this opportunity to say thank you for all that they do and for all that they do for our country. I mean, as we've kind of experienced some of these issues that we're experiencing right now from a supply standpoint, boy, it sure makes you appreciate some of these folks a lot more, for sure.
Yeah, it does. And agriculture is not just farming, too. I mean, it's a broad area. And, you've got your sales and your lending and, of course, your dealerships and all of that works together. But at the middle of that, though, is farming, and Kentucky really is, when you think about it, Kentucky really is an agriculture state. And if you know, Kentucky Ag Matters, it really does. Yep. And so, in Kentucky, there's 74,100 farm families. And, that puts us sixth in the nation as far as the number of farms. And so, that's pretty cool. I mean, when I was looking some numbers up.
That's impressive.
It's an impressive number. I didn't either until I was looking some numbers up. So that's pretty impressive. And, in Kentucky, our number one commodity is poultry and eggs. And I think that surprises a lot of people sometimes. You don't think about that, but it is. But we're also number one in burley tobacco and both dark and fire cured tobacco. So, those are some pretty good industries. And
that's real unique for this area, especially the dark fire tobacco is very unique for western Kentucky and kind of western Tennessee, that Montgomery County, Springfield area in Tennessee. And so that's for us to be able to say that's a big deal.
And if somebody hasn't seen that that smoke coming out of that barn it does, it can be a little scary for some people.
Yeah, there's a lot of times we get, you get phone calls, hey, your barn's on fire, and a lot of volunteer fire departments make some dry runs, but that's okay. We can take that, if we need to, because I'd rather be really safe than sorry, and if something is on fire, we'd like to have somebody on their way. So it's a big deal, but dark fire tobacco is very unique for this area for sure. And then Vicki, also we're like second, we're the largest beef cattle state east of the Mississippi, and that's something to be real proud of. And we also have sold through the Kentucky Beef Network. We've sold a billion pounds of Kentucky beef. And those are for those cattle that, maybe some older cows and some different things, cull cows, and we talk about that a lot. You know, we don't really have a market for that until this came around. So, I mean, this has really helped that market a lot. So
it's been a successful. Yeah. It has been a successful market, and I think it's worked really well, you know, working through Kroger. And you know, there's cattle from all across the state, too, you
Absolutely.
Know, that has participated in that. And that's a great program that's been started and a way to really put Kentucky agriculture out there. And, of course, we haven't formally introduced Jordan here, but he actually lives up closer to he lives in the central part of the state.
In
right?
the Golden Triangle.
Yeah, that's right. He lives in the big city.
Yeah.
And so a couple of our big industries are up around your way that we're probably outside of Kentucky folks know us best for.
Exactly. And two of the industries I like to support the most, I think, when it comes down to it.
There you go.
You know, we are the horse capital of the world, you know, with our equine industry. And then one of my favorite industries, the bourbon industry.
Right.
I'm a large consumer of those products, you know, support Kentucky proud.
You have to support them.
With 95% of all the bourbon in the world coming out of Kentucky, I think that's something to be really proud of. And seeing that industry grow even in the past 10 years has been phenomenal. If you haven't seen the expansion on Bluegrass Parkway, and a lot of those distilleries coming up, it's impressive.
You know, the one thing about the National Ag Week, there's a couple of things you can thank farmers for, a couple of three. You know, you're fed, you're well fed, you are well clothed, and you couldn't get drunk if you didn't have farmers. So
well, I mean, what else do you need?
So
what else do you need? So, there you go.
So those are three very important things that you know we need to think about. So thank a farmer. If you see a farmer out, thank them. Tell them how much you appreciate all they do, and because they don't hear it much, and they do appreciate hearing that every now and then.
Yep,
that is exactly right. Well, we'll kind of transition now into our topic. And as we said earlier, we've got Dr. Jordan Shockley with us, and we are really glad that it worked out for you to stop by and visit with us. As David said, he had a meeting a little further west in Kentucky, and we was able to kind of meet up on today and grab him before he headed back to that central part of the state where the bourbon is. So we're going to catch him. You know, hot topic right now in agriculture is the carbon markets. And I'm going to be honest with you, Jordan. I've been studying up a little, you know, getting ready for this. And as you know, because I asked you to help us, you know, kind of prepare. Mm-hmm. And reading through that, you know, there's a lot of moving parts. There's a lot of different things to think about. And there's a lot to that. And so, you know, we are glad that you're here with us to tell us all we ever wanted to know about carbon markets and maybe some more.
Well, maybe some things you don't want to know either. Right? That's probably the main take home on some of this when we get into this discussion is what to consider and be aware of, because it can be pretty complicated.
So just start off just telling us kind of maybe where we were and where we are or you know,
explain a little bit of
how we got here, I guess,
absolutely.
You know, and what we're headed.
Absolutely.
And what those carbon markets are. I mean, what is, you know, if somebody's that never had, you know, and our listeners, some of them may have been living under a rock and hadn't heard about carbon markets. Tell us about it.
Tell us
what we need to know.
So we'll start off with some kind of basics and things to think about. So, you know, here recently, I like to equate to, if you've seen some of these popular press, right, where some of these Fortune 500 companies are claiming they're going to want to be net neutral by a certain time into the future in reducing greenhouse gas emissions and all that. Well, how are they going to do that?
Right.
And some of these companies are purchasing what's called a carbon offset. Okay, so that means that they are going on into a market to buy a carbon credit to offset their emissions. Okay, and so we'll start there. And so if you think about that, and why even agriculture? Agriculture has been identified as a space or an industry that can generate these carbon credits to go on the market for these companies to purchase. And so when we think about agriculture and where these carbon credits are being generated in row crop production specifically, it's all about sequestering carbon in the soil. And so when we look at agriculture, how does CO2 get emitted into the atmosphere to begin with, right? There's two ways. Well, one main way is tillage. And so by adopting practices like no-till, which we've done
in Kentucky's
this,
known for.
This Kentucky's known for, yeah. As well as adopting cover crops to hold that and sequester that carbon in the soil. Those two practices are what's being adopted by producers to sequester carbon and to generate a carbon credit in the framework of this carbon market. And so when we think about carbon markets, there's really two types. And I think this is the important things that we need to realize. There's a voluntary market and a compliance-based market. Okay, so there's two types. Mm-hmm. Compliance-based is just that. That is the local or federal government coming and saying, you cannot emit greenhouse gases of some way, shape, or form in an industry. So they come down and mandate a certain cap on emissions. And so anything above that, you have to go into the open market to kind of purchase these offsets, right? That's not what's currently being done in the United States. Globally, that's what's generating and supporting these carbon markets. But that's not currently what's happening in the United States. Currently is this voluntary market. So that's your Fortune 500 companies pledging to be net neutral on a voluntary basis, right? Mm-hmm. To say we're going to be net neutral and by a certain date and time. And so when you think about that, why are these companies doing that? What's the underpinnings of these carbon markets? And there's two kind of underpinnings to think about with these markets is one's consumers, right? So as a buyer of products, we have become more environmentally conscious consumers of products. I like to give the example of shampoo. Okay, if you've ever looked on the back of a shampoo bottle, what do you see? It's usually BPA-free, environmentally friendly, free, not tested on animals,
right?
All of that stuff. And I said, well, what if you went to the store and picked up that shampoo bottle and there's a picture of a dead seal on the back of it?
Probably not going to buy it.
Probably not going to sell.
Unless it's for a Christmas joke or, you know, something like that, you're not going to buy it.
Right.
So we are more environmentally conscious consumers than we ever have been before. So it's consumers demanding companies be more environmentally friendly. And then the larger part is really shareholders. Shareholders of these Fortune 500 companies are demanding that companies have an environmentally friendly platform moving forward to reduce emissions. And so that's what's forcing in quotation marks, these companies to do that.
You know, talking about that environmentally sound, I think we've seen that too. I mean, it's just in every, you know, like you made reference to, you know, the shampoos, but it really is a driving factor for every industry just about anymore.
Absolutely. I mean, it's the airline industry, it's the Microsofts, it's the Googles, you name it. Not only consumer-based products that we see at the store, but every large corporation has some sort of corporate sustainability reporting out there that's driving these future goals for, quote, net zero.
I guess my take on it, and that's, and this is probably not real popular, but that's not helping. That's not, you know, yes, that company is buying a zero net emissions, you know, but they're not stopping their emissions. That's really not helping the problem.
So that is, in the short term, you're correct. I think the whole goal of these carbon markets is, in the short term, these companies are buying to offset. Mm-hmm. The long term goal is to hope that they invest in research and development to become more efficient, so that they, in the long term, they don't have to purchase.
It's a key word that you used. Hope.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
You have to have hope.
You have to, right? And so, so they're in the short term, they're buying these credits to meet their targets. Because again, we know if you're thinking about a power plant or some of these large energy type based companies and industries, it takes 20 years of investment to get certain technologies to reduce those emissions.
Right.
So this is an opportunity for agriculture and the folks in agriculture to be real honest about it. I mean, it is an opportunity for them to adopt certain practices to be able to sequester carbon and have that out on the open market to sell.
Yes.
And to be a positive voice for agriculture, too, to be kind of in that lane that we are being environmentally sound. I think that farmers and agriculture in general are probably more conscious of being environmentally sound than anybody out there, because that soil is their living.
Absolutely.
Yep. And they're not going to do it. If they don't take care of it, they're not going to have it to farm. They're not going to be able to make a living. And I think that there's a disconnect there with, like, the consumers, you know, just the lack of education, knowing that the soil is such a critical part of farming. But that's part of that is, like you had already mentioned earlier, that farmers really don't want a lot of thank yous and praise, and they're not really out there, you know, on the scene, you know, talking. But sometimes we do, and I think this is an opportunity to be able to shed a positive light on agriculture, yes, though.
Yeah. Absolutely. And, you know, as farmers, you know, they're the most sustainable people, environmentally friendly people that I know.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And I think there is the disconnect of not understanding that. And so it's important to get that voice out there and speak as much as we can to promote our farmers, especially in Kentucky, with the type of environmentally friendly practices that we're doing. I mean, we're the home of no-till.
Well, see, that's where I was going. So when you were talking about that, it's you mentioned, you know, that farmers can adopt these.
Yes.
What does that mean for Kentucky farmers? Because, you know, a large part of our farmers were no-tilling long before carbon markets were ever discussed. So where does that leave them and opportunities for Kentucky farmers?
Exactly. And so this is the contentious issue.
Did I ask the hard question too early?
This is the one that generates the most discussion. Sure. Because within these carbon markets, there's a concept that and a characteristic of these markets that we really need to understand, and it's called additionality. And that means that these carbon programs want you to adopt practices that sequester additional carbon in the soil. So you want to sequester additional carbon.
On top of what they're already doing?
On top of what you're already doing. Okay, because it's the concept, it's the idea of a carbon credit, right? You are adopting a practice, you're sequestering additional soil or additional carbon in the soil to generate a carbon credit to put on this market. Okay, so here comes the bad news and what we're trying to change. Because of this concept of additionality, if you are currently a no-till farmer, or currently using and adopting cover crops, you are not eligible for these carbon markets.
Because it's not additional.
Because it's not additional. Which is, I am trying to do everything that I can in my programming, extension efforts, contacts, what have you, and my colleagues across the United States are trying to change that any way possible, because to me, being in the home of no-till, you're penalizing these early adopters.
Well, because they've been doing that for years.
50 plus years.
They've been doing it before it was cool. So
exactly.
And
well, let me ask another hard question. Who's checking it?
So that is a good question. So I always get the question, okay, so I'm not eligible. What if I just break out the disc and start ripping ground to be eligible? that's not going to work because they, meaning the carbon market programs, the contracts and the companies that are enrolling farmers, they are looking back at historical farming data that you have to provide before being eligible. And so they're going back 5 years. 5 years of history. So if you rip the ground up for 5 years, then you might be eligible. But that just defeats the purpose of what we've been doing, no-till, and so it just doesn't make sense to do that.
Right.
Who's checking? You'll be out of the carbon markets in 5 years.
Exactly.
You know what I'm saying? Who knows what's going to happen in 5 years with the way things are now?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And now, as far as who's checking, if you are eligible, there are verification processes in place to make sure you are doing what you said under contractual agreement with these carbon markets.
So if you're not no-tilling on a, say on part of your acreage, you're no-tilling.
Mm-hmm.
Part of your acreage, you're not no-tilling. Yep. The part that's not being no-tilled, is that part eligible to be in that program?
Yes. So you like to think of it as on an acre basis, right? So if that acre is eligible, you could enroll that acre.
Right.
It doesn't have to. Now it depends, but it also depends on which company and the wording in the contract.
The devil's in the details.
The devil is absolutely in the details and in the fine print.
Yeah.
And so some carbon programs require you to enroll your entire farm, including the ground your house is on. Yes. And some have a minimum acre requirement, so it may be 100 acres. Some of it may just be 5 acres. So depending on how much of your ground is actually under no-till or under some sort of tillage that would be eligible.
In the same way with the cover crops, if you have not adopted that, here's what I'm asking. If you were thinking about doing cover crops, would you wait another little bit and see if this carbon market thing kind of comes to – you know, and then adopt the, say, not necessarily this fall, but maybe next fall, adopt that cover crop deal to try to be able to sell those, to try to sequester that carbon from that, you know, if you're not doing any cover crops whatsoever,
yes.
And then, you know, would you wait? What would you do?
I would, if I can get paid for doing the practice, I would wait.
And I think that's the problem, is that what you get paid is not necessarily going to offset the cost of establishing the cover crops. Is that right?
That is 100% correct.
Yep.
And even the companies and carbon programs will tell you that.
Yeah.
And it's unfortunate. And, you know, I've been doing a lot of programming across the state, the region, U.S. on these carbon markets the past 8 months. And I'm looking at these programs through the lens of an economist, right? And so we've got to keep that in mind where I'm coming from on this. I'm looking at the cost and the risk, economic risk, that adopting these practices expose our farmers to.
Which is an important lens to look through.
Yeah. And so when you think about these carbon payments, they're paying in the range of $15 to $20 per metric ton of CO2 equivalent. Do you have any clue what that means? No, right?
No.
And sometimes it's complicated on purpose, right?
Mostly.
Right? And there's a reason.
Yeah.
Okay, well, kind of putting that into our usual per acre terms that we're used to dealing with, that is in the range for no-till. You're looking at roughly on the high end $13 an acre. And then for cover crops, you're looking at $9 an acre. So as long as I've been doing this, I haven't met a farmer yet that can plant, establish, terminate a cover crop for $9 an acre.
Do they specify what type of cover crop it has to be?
Some of them go off of USDA's EQIP requirements as far as planting rates and eligible
selection.
But, like, for example, our wheat crop, no, it's not eligible.
Yeah.
Because you're not, it's a true cover crop, you can't harvest it.
Right. Yeah, that's what I was fixing to say. It has to be a true cover crop, yes, so you can harvest.
And what I was thinking too, on the lines of cover crop, it is a cover crop, but it's also a terrible weed in this part of the world. It can be is, you know, that Italian ryegrass. I mean, there was some cover crops with that, and yes. And you know, in this part of the world down here, that's a cuss word.
Yes.
Because of being in wheat.
Unless you're a cattle farmer.
Well, that's true. Yes, that's true. It depends on your audience.
That's right.
But, you know, that can be a major issue in wheat, you know, well, in wheat production, but also killing it in corn the next year. I mean, it can be a difficult weed to control. And, you know, and so you're going to have some farmers that's just not going to do that. Yeah. And I didn't know if that was, they had some kind of a lenience in there on the selection of species for their cover crop, and that may be in somebody else's area.
And well, it's also devil's in the details.
Yeah.
Yep.
Of the contract, they might have an idea. You know, the cover crops can range from just your standard cereal or rye to some 10-way mix that costs,
sure,
you know, $50 an acre on seed cost.
Yeah, and I mean, the thing about it, at $9 an acre, you're not going to get anything bought that's even remotely close to being able to be cost effective there.
And what my concern is, especially if you're thinking about this concept of additionality, so in theory, these farmers have never worked with cover crops before, and you are putting in a crop into your production system that could potentially impact your cash crop the following year. And that's a huge risk, and we've seen it in some of the studies that I've worked on, that you can take a huge yield hit if you can't get that cover crop terminated in a timely manner and get planted.
Well, here's another problem we've got. We've got a supply chain issue going on right now for Roundup and some of those things that we actually have been using for years to terminate those type of weeds and growth on our fields beforehand. So
that's right.
This is something you have to consider as well, of what we're going to be able to do there.
And you're going to have breakthroughs.
Yeah,
When you're spraying escapes. A cover crop, you're going to have escapes that's going to come back through. And those are the ones that give you so much problem. It's like a vicious cycle sometimes because you can't get it controlled after the next crop is planted either.
Well, let me ask you this, Jordan. You know, and we've talked about row crops and all that this whole time. What about our pasture folks? What about cattle farmers? What about folks that have forestry? You know, where are we at with those folks? I mean, you know, just kind of hit the top of it or whatever
so
you do.
I haven't dug deep into either of those, but I do know my colleagues in certain states, Texas being one of them, are those cattle folks are being approached to do some sort of conservation practices. I say conservation practices in the sense of grazing, rotational grazing, some sort of form fashion of that, and getting paid to enroll in some of those programs to do.
Do you have to start doing that too, or can you already be doing it?
Again, is it an additionality concept? We always bring back to that, right?
Yeah.
And so there are programs out there in certain states, not none that I know of right now for our folks in Kentucky on that livestock front. Forestry is a different animal. As well, there are two programs, carbon forestry, carbon markets, that are, from my knowledge, are supposed to be opening eligibility for Kentucky farmer or Kentucky woodland owners this year to be aware of. And it's all about management, woodland forestry management. And so similar to the issues in the carbon markets for row crops, still is kind of the same thing, but I am a lot more optimistic on the development of forest-based carbon markets for Kentucky farmers and woodland owners than I am on the row crop side of things because of one major issue, and I think that's the concept of verification. right? It's a lot easier to verify that trees are still standing than to verify that a individual farmer has adopted cover crops or is doing no-till. So the cost to those companies to verify those carbon credits is cheaper in the forestry space system. And if you look at...
Yeah, I mean, you can do that by satellite, obviously.
Exactly.
You can. That's what I was thinking.
And so proof is in the pudding in my world is that these... Where these Fortune 500 companies are going to buy, where they're going to purchase these carbon credits are these registries. And so these registries basically have done the due diligence to verify these carbon credits. And about 99% of all the carbon credits in these registries right now are forestry-based carbon credits. Okay. And so, and a lot of those are in South America,
sure,
Africa, because again, you think about it, it's easy to see that, you know, okay, we didn't cut down this portion of the rainforest. We saved it. It's sequestering carbon. There's a standard measure for that.
That's right.
Yeah. What percentage, like you're talking about, you know, you put these carbon credits in this registry, what they've got to get paid some kind of way. They're not doing it for nothing. So what percentage of that are farmers going to have to pay to them? Or how does that work, Jordan?
So I am not privy to, for example, what a Fortune 500 company is paying for these carbon credits on their end. I know it's not cheap. I'm hearing, you know, I hear numbers, but I don't.
Nothing
no,
for
sure.
Yep.
I hear what the farmers are getting offered, and that's at $15 to $20 a metric ton. My perspective is that there are numerous carbon programs out there for farmers to enroll into. Okay? And that number of companies is growing monthly.
And some are legit and some may not be as credible.
That's correct. There wouldn't be as many of these programs as there is if there wasn't money to be had.
Yeah.
And
that's what I figured. I mean, I figured somebody's
and
getting
so
paid.
When coming, looking at the lens of the farmer, right, prices are low. It's not covering your cost of doing the activities. So why... And there's risk. And a lot of these companies know that that payment is low, but they are, quote, banking on the longer-term agronomic benefit of no-till and cover crops to hopefully increase yields.
That, again, in Kentucky can almost hurt us because we figured that out 50 years ago.
Correct.
And so it's almost like the... It's almost more difficult, I think, from what you're saying in Kentucky and a lot of places, especially on the row crop side.
Yes.
It's just difficult. And
yes.
You talked about earlier about the compliance markets and the voluntary. So, I mean, do you think it'll ever move toward a compliance market? I mean, is that the, you know, are we doing voluntary now to try to keep from being a compliance, having to be a compliance market or move in that direction? Or is there any... In those circles you're in, talk
yes.
about?
Yes, so a couple things. I think we need to separate the agriculture sector versus energy, other industries. When these compliance-based systems, markets that are being generated are coming down in Europe, in Canada, in Mexico, you know, those compliance-based emissions are targeted at those other industries besides agriculture, if that makes sense. There's not going to. I don't envision a compliance-based market that comes down and says, "Farmer X, you have to do no-till."
Right.
That's not happening, in my opinion.
Right.
It may be like energy industry X. You can't.
You shall do this.
You shall do this, and then find ways to offset your emissions in some sort of market. And again, if you think about this from a compliance base, we were here about 15 years ago. Mm-hmm. Okay. There's, you know, in the U.S., we have a cap and trade program on greenhouse gas emissions on sulfur in California. Okay. That generated, that created a sulfur-based market, similar to what we're thinking about, these carbon markets. And so a market was developed. It was called the Chicago Climate Exchange. Seeing the success of the sulfur market, this Chicago Climate Exchange was developed and was traded on CME to, in anticipation of a compliance-based carbon system years ago. Okay, that was developed. Well, what happened was that was developed. There was active trading going on. Those carbon credits reached a peak of $7 a metric ton of CO2 equivalent, to give you a perspective at that point. And then what happened was administration changed over in Washington, D.C., and that legislation on cap and trade for carbon got put to the wayside, which then collapsed that
momentum
and the trading of that carbon market program. So we've been here in anticipation of a compliance-based market. This is not what we are in today. Okay, we are not there. This is this voluntary. And I always get the question, well, what if we talk about changing of administration in D.C.? What happens? Are these carbon markets going to go away like they did before if the administration changes over in 2024?
Which is a very viable question.
Very viable question. But I go back to the very beginning on what's driving these markets. As of right now, the federal government has kept their hands out of the carbon market space. This is driven by Fortune 500 companies. A lot of these Fortune 500 companies are global companies. I don't think, and I don't anticipate, if there's a change in administration, that these carbon markets are going anywhere just because of how they're being developed right now and the backbone of that, which is corporations, not government entities. Now, what scares me on the compliance-based system, and I talk about this to producers, is what will happen with carbon markets on the international trade front? And I've been talking to some of our trade economists, specialists, that I give the example, what happens if Europe requires that all products and goods that get imported into Europe have to be carbon or net neutral? That could be.
And we've seen some of that. We've seen some of that, depending on what the industry is, like the meat industry.
Yep. And
we've
so
seen some of that.
That could, I don't want to say artificially push us towards a compliance-based system. But that's the only way I see really a quote compliance basis. Because even in the current administration, they've gone away from the carbon aspect to a more specific greenhouse gas, and that's the methane. Mm-hmm. We've recently seen their focus change. And they're not coming down and on a compliance-based mandating cap and trade on the methane, but what they are doing is providing funding to support adoption of practices for two industries, one dairy, and two your rice folks. Because a little known fact to me that I had to look up is the largest methane emission crop in the world is rice.
I did not know that.
I did not, because it's flooded. And that flooding creates that methane that gets released.
Is there another industry that will be able to be a part of sequestering carbon like agriculture?
That's a good question.
I didn't
sequestering is a, we're holding it in the soil, right? That's the,
yep.
So if we think about it, and I'll turn it just a little bit, all these industries are trying to find ways to become more efficient on their energy emissions. And so what they can do, if they reach their target, any additional carbon emissions that they're able to sequester over and above what their target is, they are creating carbon credits that they can trade between companies. That's what you're seeing in California, cap and trade, mm-hmm. right? So some of these sulfur emitting companies are more efficient than others. You know, maybe it's a brand new energy type mm-hmm. company, and you have an older, you know, 50-year-old
that has upgraded equipment
yeah. or the money to do it. Mm-hmm. They are generating sulfur credits that they're able to trade with other businesses.
Yeah. Yeah.
But
so,
right now,
so they could be in the market too, like agriculture.
Yes, yes. As far as sequestering in the soil,
right.
No. I mean,
right.
Besides, I mean, ag. You know,
yeah.
You know, we've got a upper hand here, and so I think there's opportunity, but there's costs that need to be considered, and you're getting paid, and people are seeing that there's payments, but you have to understand the intricacies and the details of these contracts, because they are brutal.
And you have to be, I think, you have to think about it. That producer is going to have to think about it outside of just dollars and cents that you can count, that's tangible, because it's kind of like you were saying, the long term, they're hoping that it's those agronomic benefits that you're going to see when you start doing these practices and maybe – you know, improve yields or whatever the case may be, you know, that you're getting benefit on that side,
yep.
more of an intangible type increase, I guess.
Yeah, and, you know, when we think about sustainability, right, and sometimes that seems like a four-letter word, depending on what crowd you're in. I come at it from an economist. You have to be economically sustainable,
yep.
right?
Sure.
So if you adopt a practice like cover crops and you do widespread adoption as far as on your farming operation, and it gets out of control for whatever reason, and you cut your yields in half, and you're not able to bankroll that year because of that practice, that's not sustainable.
And we've all seen there was cover crops that's been planted that were never terminated.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then you've got a mess the next year.
Yes, and so it's just there's risk.
Yeah, it is.
Well, it sounds like that we're going to have a follow up show.
I think
just about guaranteed.
Yeah. We're going to have a part two. So
yeah,
you
we're
going
to have
that
a
mind,
part
Jordan.
Two sometime.
Absolutely.
So, and maybe we can have a little more information about how things are developing here in about 6 months or so. We'll have you back on.
Absolutely.
So, and we want you to jump in on this timely tip. But our timely tip for this week is ask lots of questions. Read the fine print and seek legal advice before signing any contractual agreements in regards to carbon markets.
I 100% agree. It is crucial that you, to me, read that fine print. Devil's in the details. A lot of the details are in the appendix or the definition section of these contracts, and it gets confusing. So please seek legal advice, because each one of these companies has a completely different type of structure of payments, different ways you qualify, different documentation required, different issues of how they get onto your farm,
right,
and accessibility. And it is imperative that you just don't sign something that you're not 100% comfortable with, and have a lawyer present, because I don't want to see what I'm seeing happening to some producers that are signing up blanketly and getting themselves into trouble and not setting themselves up to have an opportunity in the long run when ideally these prices will increase once demand increases for these carbon credits.
Yeah, and they're signing long-term agreements that are not, I mean, long. When I say long-term, it's long-term, isn't it?
Exactly, yes. So the average contract is 10 years, but there are companies that are have contracts for 100 years.
So that's definitely something to think about for sure, and we want to appreciate Dr. Jordan Shockley being here with us, and we want to let folks know we missed Jay, and he's out on vacation this week. So Vicki and I and Dr. Jordan Shockley have all jumped in here and hosted this. So we appreciate that, and we want to thank our listeners for joining in. We hope you have enjoyed our show. We'll make plans to join us again next week for our next episode. And until then, remember, Kentucky Ag Matters.